happy. Telford had cracked the pricing problem that had doomed his first proposal. Still, he was under no illusions. No matter how he presented his new idea, his bosses wouldn't get it. They were the old guard, sitting in their comfortable offices in Zurich, Switzerland, or Midland, Michigan, far from Silicon Valley, the epicenter of the digital revolution. Someone had to rattle their traditional way of thinking. Telford had built a reputation inside Dow for doing just that. In the weeks leading up to his big presentation about the new pricing scheme, Telford devised a bold, some might say reckless, plan for convincing his bosses. He drafted a fake email that would alert leaders at his company to an impending competitive announcement. As the rumor went, a major chemical distributor, two chemical competitors, and a large internet company were joining forces to create a new online site called epoxiesareus.com. When his bosses saw this correspondence, Telford reasoned, they would perceive the new online site as a major threat to Dow and agree to fund his epoxy idea. It didn't matter that the emails were fake. Telford would have made his point. The email went out. To lend it credibility, Telford had a spoof television segment created where a journalist, an analyst, and a distributor, all acquaintances of Telford's who were in on the spoof, commented on the news and announced that Dow's stock price had tumbled 10% in response. Telford let it be known that through his contacts, he could rush a copy of the upcoming television interview to headquarters for the leadership team to preview. On the day the video arrived, Telford holed himself up in a conference room and watched from a distance as the drama played out. Most people on the leadership team watched the video all the way through, oblivious to the ruse. The big boss, however, watched for 30 seconds before he shouted, "Telford!" and ran out the door. His boss's boss was angry and didn't talk to him for a month, but he acknowledged that the stunt did serve as a wake-up call. Having aroused leaders' fears about the prospect of losing in the marketplace, Telford got $1 million in seed money to develop the eepoxy.com venture. The pricing solution wasn't ideal, he thought, but he had made a workable concession with the promo code. Then came an organizational earthquake. A new president, Bob Wood, took over the division after a reorganization. Wood put Telford's project on hold pending review. Read the death knell. If Telford had any hope of succeeding, he had to muster support for his project all over again, and fast. Unbowed, he got to work. He presented his idea to Wood's senior managers, convincing them to rank eepoxy.com as the most critical project for the division to pursue. Then he cajoled his boss to set up an urgent meeting with Wood. In that session, Telford extolled the merits of his venture in the strongest possible terms. "The key was Ian's enthusiasm," Wood enthused. "I was betting on the entrepreneur. I had to look him in the eye and see if he had fire in his belly." Wood approved the project. Now Telford was in business again. With a hand-picked and terrific three-person team in place, he moved fast. But he faced one more obstacle. Dow's IT department sought to stifle his venture. They didn't want some lowly epoxy person like Telford building his own online system. "Our big fear was fragmentation and incompatibility," said one manager. To neutralize their threat to shut him down, Telford resolved to become a model internal customer. He labored to meet all of IT's requirements, including those for standardization, every time and on schedule. When the new online epoxy business clocked its first customer order, he picked up the phone and called to congratulate his IT colleagues, telling them, "This is as much your success as it is mine." Thanks to his outreach, IT came to see themselves as playing an important part in the project. 14 months after its debut, the online eepoxy.com business was operating in the United States and Europe. The site was built on time and under budget, and it became Dow's most successful e-business, creating a positive cash flow in less than a year. Telford was promoted, becoming one of Dow's top 200 leaders worldwide before leaving the company in 2008 for another endeavor. Convincing other people. As Telford's story demonstrates, getting our work done hinges on our ability to gain support from others, including bosses, subordinates, peers, colleagues in other departments, and partners. These individuals control resources we need: information, expertise, money, staff, and political cover. Yet they may not wish to lend a hand, and they may even block our efforts. Telford would have gotten nowhere if he hadn't understood how to surmount obstacles without alienating the senior leaders and IT staff who opposed his project. His awareness of others' concerns, coupled with his ability to convince, enabled him to have substantial impact. The ability to advocate for one's goals and gain the required support is only one of a broader set of people interaction skills required in modern workplaces. An IBM study of 1,709 CEOs concluded that CEOs are changing the nature of work by adding a powerful dose of openness, transparency, and employee empowerment to the command and control ethos. Organizations are flatter and less hierarchical. As a result, employees and managers must interact more across departments and work more in teams, including teams composed of members from different departments. That changes the skills you need to succeed in your job. In the IBM study, 2/3 of CEOs regarded collaboration and communication as key drivers of employee success to operate in a more complex, interconnected environment. We found in our study that such complexity has made certain skills more important. As respondents told us, employees and managers now have to become more adept at working with people from many different departments, over whom they have no formal authority. A full 69% strongly or completely agreed with the statement that in their job it was important to work with people from different areas of the company. Analyzing our data, we found that top performers mastered working with others in three areas: advocacy, teamwork, and collaboration. The next chapter focuses on how to perform by working in teams, while Chapter 8 discusses how to collaborate effectively across boundaries. In this chapter, we explore the vital task of advocating for your goals so as to win other people's support. Champion forcefully. Many of us believe that we need to appeal to people's rational minds to gain their support for our projects and goals. Just explain the merits of the case using logic and data, and others will rise up in support. And so we present rational arguments in lengthy emails and PowerPoint presentations in an effort to convince. And if we can't snare people's attention with one email, well, we just send another one and another one. If they don't get it, we hammer our argument even harder. We fall once again into the do more paradigm of work, drowning people in an all too familiar avalanche of emails, slides, texts, reports, and data. Communicating more of the same when people aren't listening or accepting our message doesn't seem like a smart way to work. When we analyzed our case studies, I was struck by how the best performers went beyond rational arguments and adopted various tactics to advocate for their projects. I discovered that the best advocates, what I call forceful champions, effectively pursued their goals at work by mastering two skills to gain the support of other people. They inspired others by evoking emotions, and they circumvented resistance by deploying smart grit. First, the forceful champions in our study inspired people, appealing to their emotions as well as their rational minds to garner support. As Maya Angelou reminds us, people never forget how you make them feel. Her point is echoed by academic theories that show how leaders gain support by making others feel excited about their vision, goals, and plans. While leadership theory often emphasizes the role of personal charisma in eliciting such emotions, you don't need to be charismatic to inspire others. The forceful champions in our study used a number of practical techniques to stir emotions that everyone can adopt, regardless of their job titles. The second skill that the forceful champions in our study used, smart grit, entails persevering in the face of difficulty and deploying tailored tactics to overcome opposition to their effort. Psychologists such as University of Pennsylvania professor Angela Duckworth have demonstrated that grit, which she defines as perseverance and passion for long-term goals, distinguishes successful people from others. In pursuing their goals, forceful champions in our study applied such grit to overcome opposition. But rather than simply plod forward, mustering endless amounts of energy and verbiage to overcome obstacles, they also deployed smart tactics to address their colleagues' specific concerns. Like Ian Telford, they identified and read their opponent's intentions and took steps such as compromising or co-opting to convince them to support their cause. As our study found, inspiring others and applying smart grit is a highly effective way to advocate for one's goals. The most forceful champions in our 5,000-person study were likely to be ranked 15 percentage points higher in their performance ranking than those who didn't practice these skills. Ian Telford scored high in both areas. His inspirational score was 6.3 out of a potential top score of 7, while his smart grit score was 6.8. His total forceful champion score placed him in the 97th percentile in our 5,000-person dataset, and he performed exceptionally well, as we saw, with the epoxy business. Like Telford, managers and employees in our study who scored high on both inspiration and smart grit performed much better than those who could manage either inspiration or smart grit, but not both. Interestingly, the impact of being a more forceful champion was much larger for men than for women. Our data didn't explain why, although I can offer a few speculations. It may be that men deploy these tactics more effectively because they feel more confident trying to influence others, having done so more often over the years and perceiving it as normal. Or perhaps gender stereotypes play a role, leading people to celebrate forceful tactics in men and disparage them in women. As studies have shown, people commonly perceive women in the workplace as either competent or liked, but not both. Research shows that when competent women assert themselves, as forceful champions do, they risk being sanctioned and downgraded. One study, for example, found that in a sample of 76 supervisory employee relationships in a law enforcement agency in the southwestern United States, female employees who asserted themselves by using tactics such as deal forcefully with others when they hamper their ability to get their job done received lower performance ratings than women who didn't use such tactics. Male colleagues, in contrast, received higher ratings when displaying the same behaviors. So when a boss evaluates a man who uses forceful champion tactics, the boss may think, "Wow, smart guy." When a competent woman does the same, he may think, "Really aggressive woman," and downgrade his perception of her performance. Our finding in part may be shaped by such a gender stereotype. People regard female forceful champions as performing more poorly than their male counterparts when in reality they are not. Despite the gender difference, everyone in our study benefited from becoming forceful champions. Let's examine the forceful champion tactics in more detail, considering first the task of appealing to others' emotions so that they want to support our efforts. Make them upset and excited. A great way to inspire others is to foster both negative and positive emotions, getting people upset about the present and excited about the future. Ian Telford got it all wrong at first. In proposing his idea for an online business, he aroused negative emotions among the managers. They worried that the future online business would cannibalize their existing business, and they felt happy about the present state, meaty profits from that existing business. Telford's spoof reversed those emotions, rendering his bosses fearful about the current state, falling behind the competition, and joyful about the prospect of keeping existing customers and adding revenues from new online customers. Now their emotions lined up in Telford's favor, and they supported his proposal. Of course, the prank was borderline unethical, and as such, it sparked an additional emotion that risked getting out of hand. Anger. At him. Telford's strategy points to an important insight about emotions. When your goal is to convince, not all emotions are equal. In a study reported in his book Contagious, Wharton Business School professor Jonah Berger scrutinized online messages and specifically the importance of high arousal emotions. These emotions prompt a state of activation and readiness for action. The heart beats faster and blood pressure rises. Excitement and joy are high arousal emotions, as are anxiety and anger. Contentment and sadness aren't. In his analysis of New York Times articles published over a 3-month period, Berger and co-author Catherine Milkman found that articles producing high arousal emotions were 24 to 38% more likely to make the most emailed list than those that evoked other types of emotions. People acted on those high arousal emotions. Make people mad, not sad, Berger concludes. To inspire people and gain their support, line up high arousal emotions on your side. Make them mad and fearful about the present and joyful and excited about your proposed future goal. When persuading others to follow your lead, you will want to provoke the following negative emotions about the status quo: fear, anger, frustration, resentment, disgust, anxiety. And you will want to evoke the following positive emotions about the future state, that is, your goal: excitement, joy, passion, thrill, ecstasy, delight. Many of us stumble by lining up high arousal emotions incorrectly. Mike London, a 45-year-old manager in our study, had a nifty cost-cutting idea for the sales office he was managing. No more free coffee in the office. The policy backfired, leading to minuscule cost savings and disgruntled employees. Why? Because the change sparked fury among his office workers about the future state, no free coffee, and nostalgia about the status quo, that delightful aroma of fresh-brewed dark roast in the morning. London could have taken a different approach. He could have angered his team members by pointing to the paltry bonuses they'd received the past year, and he could have fired up his team by showing them how much bigger the bonus pool would be if they could reduce operational costs. He could have made team members upset about today and excited for tomorrow, as opposed to the other way around. Show it. Don't just tell. In 2009, celebrity chef Jamie Oliver faced an arduous task: convincing residents of Huntington, West Virginia, America's most unhealthy town, to eat more healthily. Arriving at an elementary school, he prepared a delicious and healthy meal of chicken and vegetables and asked the kids, "Chicken or pizza?" "Pizza!" they yelled. Oliver could have reasoned with parents, convincing them to change the behavior of their little pizza lovers. He could have recited the brutal facts: 32% of the town was obese, and 3 in 5 kids were overweight. Yet rational arguments probably wouldn't work, not least because many locals were skeptical of Oliver. West Virginia had long been the butt of jokes among residents of wealthier parts of the United States. Having a British chef come to teach them how to cook, well, that was too much. Oliver dispensed with rational arguments. He convened a meeting of parents and kids in a parking lot. They arrived to find Oliver directing a giant truck into the lot, microphone in hand. Backing up toward the parents and kids, the truck dumped a massive load of pure animal fat into a huge open dumpster right in front of them. A big, white, disgusting mountain of fat. Giant, jiggling blobs of it. "This is the fat consumed by the entire school for 1 year," Oliver yelled. He jumped on top of the mound, grabbed a chunk, held it up, and cried, "Come feel it!" "No!" the kids screamed back in disgust. The parents were aghast. Oliver lifted a hunk of fat into the air and addressed the parents. "Are you fine with this? No, they shouted. Oliver surveyed the crowd. You need to know I am on your side, he said. And then came the pitch. Parents, will you support me? Yes, they howled. Oliver knew he needed to arouse emotions, but he also knew that words, even rich, vibrant ones, wouldn't garner the impact he desired. So he endeavored to show, not tell, what kids were eating at school. The mountain of fat looked ugly, and it was ugly. The sight of it hit parents in their gut and generated feelings of anger and disgust, and, I am sure, guilt. Oliver aroused negative feelings about the status quo and then led the charge with a passion for healthier eating. Like Oliver, a number of people in our study used photos, artifacts, videos, and demonstrations to dramatize their arguments and stir up emotions. Remember Peggy Bree from the Theta Care Hospital in Appleton, as we discussed in Chapter 2? To convince the cardiologists to cut out their step in the treatment of heart attack patients, she didn't just argue with numbers. No, she took them on a road trip and showed them another hospital that had accomplished the feat. They could literally stand there and watch the demonstration unfold as the staff at that other hospital went through the steps without the cardiologist. Yet, showing, not telling, is by no means a common tactic. Only 18% of people in our 5,000-person dataset scored high on the statement, frequently taps into people's emotions to get them excited about their work. That's too bad. As our study also revealed, arousing emotional responses gets results, including for junior people. In fact, about 19% of people in either a senior job position, division manager, or a junior one, technical specialist, scored very high on their ability to stir emotions. Consider Elise, a 33-year-old junior purchasing employee at a large global manufacturer. She was spearheading a project converting paper forms to electronic ones. Although she was convinced that they could save money this way, it was difficult to excite people over such a mundane initiative. Hearing that the firm's CEO was visiting her Swiss subsidiary, Elise dumped a pile of paper and dozens of thick binders full of regulations and paperwork onto a table in a large conference room. Imagine, thousands of pages rising 2 to 3 feet high. When the CEO arrived, Elise escorted him into the room and explained what he was looking at. Holy cow, the CEO burst out, stupefied and frustrated. Why do we use so much paper? From then on, Elise and her project received support. Make them feel purpose. Our study revealed a third technique that forceful champions use to inspire people. Connecting daily work to a broader purpose. Many companies have purpose or mission statements. One of the best known is Disney's purpose, to make people happy. But purpose isn't just something for companies and CEOs. It's for all of us. As we saw in Chapter 5, individuals perform better if they have a strong sense of purpose in their work. You can also use purpose to inspire other people so that they will commit to your projects and goals. In 2015, I delivered a keynote address to senior leaders at the life science high-tech firm Agilent Technologies. Before my presentation, I stood at the back of the auditorium as the speaker preceding me, an Agilent executive named Jacob Thason, presented his division's strategy. His business develops instruments used by scientists in the course of developing new drug treatments and diagnosing diseases. His presentation was dense with numbers and facts to outline and support the strategy. Some in the audience slouched in their chairs and strained to follow his impressive command of the numbers and logic. In the course of wrapping up, Thason said, "I would like to highlight how our instruments have an impact." I was expecting still more slides, but instead, he played a video clip from the Forbes Healthcare Summit. It showed an athletic 22-year-old woman named Corey Wood who was stricken by lung cancer. She related how advanced instrumentation and DNA sequencing had allowed her doctors to understand her disease on a molecular level. determining that her normally fatal cancer stemmed from a specific genetic abnormality, her doctors administered a targeted drug treatment that cured her of the disease. She was alive and healthy, she said, tears welling in her eyes as she thanked everyone who had helped save her young life. As Corey Wood spoke, audience members sat up straight and ignored their smartphones, captivated by the young woman's story. After the video, Thason made the connection. Her treatment would not have been possible without the instruments and reagents we develop. Silence. You could almost see a giant speech bubble hovering over the room. Now that's why we come to work. In the single masterful moment that Thason orchestrated, work became connected with deeper purpose. 6 months later, when I had lunch with Agilent CEO Mike McMullen and Human Resources Vice President Dominique Grau, they told me that people were still talking about that moment. While Thason inspired a crowd with a lofty purpose, people in our study managed to connect an overarching purpose to even the most tedious of tasks. Fernando Lopez was a 37-year-old supply chain specialist working for a New Jersey medical device company. Managing all the manufacturing done by external suppliers for the company's dialysis product, he felt a direct connection between his daily tasks and the compelling purpose of helping dialysis patients. But the people working in the outsourced manufacturing plants didn't feel that at all. "They do a piece of the pie for us, and they don't understand necessarily what the pie is," Lopez said. As a result, they weren't working as intensely as they might have when manufacturing and shipping the company's product. To inspire the plant workers, Lopez traveled to their site to meet with them. "I gave them a lot of background and understanding on what they're actually doing, what they're doing for us, and why it's valuable. I showed them that what they were doing was actually helping patients with kidney failures, and it resonated with everyone. I got a lot of feedback about how that had inspired them to put a little bit of extra effort into what they were doing, because they realized it had a big impact." The manufacturing team did a better job supporting Lopez's scheduling and quality goals, increasing Lopez's own performance. He scored in the top 15% on the forceful champion behaviors and landed in the top 20% in our performance ranking. Research confirms the power of connecting daily work to purpose. Wharton Professor Adam Grant and colleagues conducted a study of people working at a call center to raise university alumni donations for scholarships. Hour after hour, the callers worked on the phone, struggling through frequent rejections and never witnessing what happened with the money they raised. To change this, their manager showed the callers letters written by thankful students who'd received scholarships funded through their efforts. He then arranged a meeting with a scholarship student who explained to the callers face-to-face how their efforts had transformed his life. "Remember this when you're on the phone. This is someone you're supporting," the manager remarked at the end of the meeting. A month later, their weekly average fundraising increased from $185.94 to $503.22. If you make people feel the purpose, they will try that much harder to help you achieve your goals. The tactics of lining up emotions properly, showing and not just telling, and making people feel purpose enable you to inspire people so that they will support your efforts. Everyone can use these tactics. You don't have to have a charismatic personality to inspire colleagues at work. Yet sometimes these inspirational tactics alone are not enough to overcome opposition to your plans and goals. Forceful champions, we learned in our study, also persevere against a constant stream of obstacles to reach their goals. Smart grit. In 1998, Arunachalam Maruganatham, a resident of the rural village of Coimbatore in the Indian state of Tamil Nadu, caught his young bride, Shanti, hiding something from him. She was collecting filthy rags, and when he inquired, she admitted that she used them to absorb blood during menstruation. "I would not even use it to clean my scooter," he confessed. He asked why she didn't use sanitary pads. She replied that if she bought pads, she'd have to cut our family milk budget. Muruganatham decided to do something about it. He set out to develop his own cheap pad that his wife and others could use. He first designed a prototype sanitary pad made of local cotton and asked his wife to try it. It didn't work, and his wife soon returned to using a rag. He realized that it would take years to develop a marketable product if he could only test it on his wife once a month. So he tried to conscript her sister, but she refused. Then he approached female medical students in the area who rejected him as well. In this traditional society, no one seemed eager to help a lowly, uneducated villager. Muruganatham had dropped out of school at age 14 to support his family. Muruganatham eventually convinced 20 medical students to try his homemade pad and complete a survey. One day, however, he caught three girls filling out their surveys with fake data, sinking his study. With no one to test his experimental pad, he had crashed. Then, an idea occurred to him. Maybe he could test it on himself. He filled the bladder of a soccer ball with goat's blood that he obtained from a butcher friend. He strapped the bladder under his garment, donned a sanitary pad, and clambered about, squeezing it as if it were his uterus to see if his invention would absorb the squirts. Unfortunately, the goat blood started to stink in the heat. Some of the villagers suspected that he had gone mad. It got worse. After months of this eccentric behavior, his wife couldn't stand the social censure and moved out. That should have been the end of it, but Muruganatham kept going. Determined to study used sanitary pads, he approached the medical students again and gave them pads, which he later collected. One Sunday, his mother caught him studying rows of bloody pads lined up in the backyard and started to cry. She, too, moved out. The villagers were convinced that he was possessed by evil spirits and threatened to chain him upside down to a tree to be cleansed by the local soothsayer. Muruganatham escaped only by agreeing to leave the village. "I was left all alone in life," Muruganatham said. Yet he soldiered on. Noting that cotton releases liquid under pressure, he wondered what material multinationals like Procter & Gamble and Johnson & Johnson used in their pads that allowed them to retain liquid. Only when Muruganatham got his hands on samples of the raw material did he realize what he was up against. The big companies employed expensive machines to process tree bark into cellulose, which doesn't release absorbed liquid when squeezed. Time to give up? Muruganatham kept going. He figured that he needed to build his own mini-cellulose plant. He started from scratch, breaking the task into four parts: defibration, packing, wrapping and finishing, and disinfection. He fabricated simple devices for each, powering them wherever possible by humans pedaling. 4.5 years later, he had his machines. They were simple and cheap, and they looked scrappy, but they converted cellulose into sanitary pads at low cost. He had his pad, finally. Muruganatham distributed free sanitary pads to the villagers who had banished him. The next day he spotted kids playing with them in the streets and men using them to buff their scooter headlights. But women weren't using them. He had built it, but no one came. As we discussed in Chapter 3, he fulfilled his objective, building the machine, but created zero value for its intended beneficiaries, women benefiting from using the pads. By any measure of grit, Muruganatham was off the charts. He spent 7 years pressing ahead against severe obstacles. Although such perseverance is extreme, it is not uncommon. About a quarter of managers and employees, 27% in our study, scored very high on the statement, "He or she relentlessly pursues objectives, no matter the obstacles he or she faces." Ian Telford at Dow Chemical scored a 7, highest on this statement. As we saw, he kept pursuing his venture, even though it met with resistance at first and almost died when a new boss arrived. Telford and the other such gritty people in our study performed better than those who didn't show grit, confirming the general hypothesis that sheer grit helps people reach goals and perform. Yet, as Muruganatham's case suggests, such traditional grit has its limits. Muruganatham persevered in pursuing his goal, and it got him nowhere. To vanquish opposition in the workplace, you must do more than persevere. You also need to tailor your tactics to neutralize opposition from people. Although Muruganatham had made the pads available and affordable, he had alienated the very people he was trying to help, his wife, mother, sister, and the poor villagers. As a result, they weren't using and spreading the word about his pads. His relentless pursuit, his grit, prompted him to adjust elements of his production or operational strategy, where to get the pads, how to test his idea, how to build the machine, but his approach to people remained rigid. He didn't listen to their concerns and instead barreled ahead. His sheer grit frightened them away. Grit at work is not about putting your head down and bulldozing through successive walls of resistance. Smart grit involves not only persevering, but also taking into account the perspective of people you're trying to influence and devising tactics that will win them over. Empathize with your opponents. Warm sunlight filtered in through the windows at Volpe Foods, a small St. Louis company selling Italian cured meat like salami and prosciutto. Lorenza Pacetti, who would take over the family business from her father, was away at a foods show. It was a perfect time for staff back in the office to catch up on some admin. Then the office fax machine spat out a terse message from one of Volpe's biggest customers, the giant retailer Costco. Pacetti was chatting with a customer when she received a frantic call from the office. The fax was a copy of a threatening letter sent to Costco from the U.S. attorney of the powerful Consorzio del Prosciutto di Parma, one of Italy's global enforcers of food trademarks. The letter denounced our prosciutto product and charged Volpe with infringement of U.S. label law, Pacetti explained in an interview for our study. This situation was nothing short of a crisis, and it attacked Volpe's reputation, one we had built over a century. It was the first volley in a surprise assault. The Consorzio charged Volpe with violating the law through its use of words like Italian, traditional, and prosciutto on its label, claiming that the company did not use traditional Italian methods for curing the meat. The charge would trigger a U.S. Department of Agriculture, USDA, investigation. Fearing a Consorzio lawsuit for carrying Volpe products, clients like Costco might pull their products from the shelves. Pacetti jumped on the phone with the USDA to see where she stood. The regulators made it worse. Although they had approved Volpe's product labeling, they now claimed to have erred. They ordered Volpe to remove the word Italian from the labels. Their entire brand identity was based on being Italian, and now they couldn't use the word Italian? Pacetti wasn't sure what to do. She could go on the offensive, but few in her company had the heart for a long legal battle. Her father, who had run the business for 45 years, saw no way out. As Pacetti related, her dad comes from a generation that believes in attorneys and trusts what they say. That generation wouldn't think of going against what attorneys told you. My brother-in-law, who was in the family business at that time, also thought we should give in. Instead of countering right away, Pacetti spent time reflecting on the situation. She tried to see the issue from the Consorzio's point of view. Why were they after Volpe? Researching it, she realized that they weren't out to grab market share in the United States for domestic Italian producers. No, the Consorzio seemed obsessed with protecting the Italian heritage in production methods, making sure Italian meant Italian. That was what the fight was about. Based on this insight, Pacetti crafted a strategy. Forget about the American lawyer. Forget about the USDA. Pacetti would take the fight to the homeland. As a first-generation Italian-American, she spoke fluent Italian and had visited the old country hundreds of times for work and pleasure. I buy a lot of equipment from Italy, she explained, and most of the manufacturers are located around the northern Italian city of Parma. I asked one of the oldest and most respected equipment manufacturers to organize a meeting between the consortium and me. I thought that if they met me and I explained who we are and how we keep their traditions alive, they would agree to talk to their U.S. attorney. And by talking to the attorney, I meant tell him to back off. On a sweltering day in August, Fassetti showed up in Parma and strode into the meeting room of her friend's equipment manufacturing headquarters. Facing her from across the massive 300-year-old table were two Italian businessmen nearly twice her age. She told them the Volpi story, how the family company had maintained a painstaking commitment to the Italian curing method, handed down from one generation to the next. She implored the consortio leaders to have some mercy on a company with a rich Italian heritage. "It was a little bit of theater, but it worked," Pacetti said, smiling. The old men were convinced. The consortio relented. Pacetti's story illustrates how we can deploy smart grit in professional settings. Her first step in overcoming the opposition was to understand why the men in Italy were threatening her business. When she saw the situation from their point of view, she realized it had to do with Italian heritage. That was the crucial insight. Psychologists call her approach cognitive empathy, which we can define as the capacity to understand another's perspective or mental state. In his book Power, Stanford Business School professor Jeffrey Pfeffer states that putting yourself in the other's place is one of the best ways to advance your own agenda. He notes, however, that our obsession with our own concerns and objectives prevents us from doing so. We assume that opponents just don't get it, and thus we pummel them with more facts and arguments in an effort to make them get it. That's working hard, not smart. Why might colleagues oppose you? Maybe they have conflicting agendas and their priorities clash with yours. A colleague might want to obtain resources for his marketing project, but your project will make that more difficult, so he will oppose your goals. People in organizations also play favorites, and you might not be among them. Alternatively, colleagues may perceive your department as an enemy, and thus seek to undermine your efforts, even though they have nothing against you personally. In other situations, people may feel threatened by change, and they may perceive your proposal as too risky. That's how Dow's leadership reacted to Ian Telford's idea. Other times, people simply lack time or budget to lend you their support. Maybe their budgets just got cut, and your project drops to the bottom of their priority list. Often, people's objections are reasonable if you only take the time to see the issue from their point of view. Figure out what their considerations are, and you can take steps to surmount them. Confront or make concessions. Smart grit isn't just about empathizing. Action matters. Once Pacetti understood her opponent's position, she decided to confront the consortio in person. The tactic worked for her, yet confrontation can prove risky. Another option, making concessions, carries far less risk. Ian Telford conceded certain parts of his plan so as to overcome opposition to his eepoxy.com business. After his first failed attempt, he empathized with the leadership team members and understood their anxiety about showing the prices on the Internet. To appease the opposing members, he offered to publicize a very high price on the Internet and then use the promo code to give customers the real price. Without this concession, his venture would never have gone forward, as the senior leaders would have voted it down yet again. A promo code wasn't ideal, but he could tolerate it. The pricing accommodation wasn't do or die for Telford, as the labeling was for Pacetti at Volpi Foods. He could find a middle ground. Whenever you can, give in a little bit to silence the naysayers. Invite the opposition into your tent. When you can't bring yourself to concede anything, try turning your adversaries into allies, or, as academics call it, co-opting them. Ian Telford deployed such tactics with the Corporate Information Technology Department that sought to torpedo his venture. He first strove to understand their concern, their desire to standardize IT systems across the company. Then, he labored to alleviate those concerns and become a model internal customer. To grasp complicated IT issues, he spent hours talking to external IT firms like Accenture. He learned IT-specific terms to speak their language. Understanding their constraints prevented him from making unreasonable demands, as so many Dow managers did. When the new online epoxy business clocked its first customer order, he even picked up the phone and called IT to congratulate them. That gesture made a big difference, Telford said. It made the IT folks feel like co-owners of the project. And the more they felt that way, the easier it was to get them and keep them on my side. Our tendency when confronted by opponents is to pull out our swords and charge into battle. Yet sometimes it serves our own interests to make people part of our project, if possible. President Lyndon B. Johnson is supposed to have quipped about an opponent, "It's probably better to have him inside the tent pissing out than outside pissing in." Whenever you can, work smart and invite the opposition into your tent. Mobilize people. Don't go it alone. There is one more act to the story about Muruganatham, the menstrual man, as he is sometimes called. Once he had built the machine and produced the pads that women didn't use, his project had stalled. 7 years of hard work had yielded zero value for the women he aimed to help. But rather than give up, he realized his mistake and tried to fix it. He had barreled ahead without involving impoverished women, the very group he had tried to help. So now he turned his strategy around. He began to enlist women's help in convincing other women to use the sanitary pads. With some aid money, Muruganatham placed machines in several villages and trained local women to use, produce, and sell the pads. Now, women rallied to set up machines and start businesses. They began educating other women and selling pads to them. Not only were they helping improve health and hygiene, they were seizing the opportunity to become entrepreneurs and earn a living selling pads. By mobilizing women to convince yet more women, Muruganatham built an ever-growing coalition of influencers. Impact at last. Muruganatham's own wife and mother returned, and the villagers took him back. This smart grit tactic, and not grit alone, made him succeed. Too many people try to get others to change by doing all the convincing themselves. They become lone crusaders for their efforts, and they exhaust themselves in the process. It's better to enlist even just a few people to help convince others. In our study, some managers and employees rallied emissaries. 29% scored high on the statement, "She or he is very effective in mobilizing people to make change happen." Ian Telford scored a 7, highest on this statement. As you'll remember, he mobilized his boss to get an urgent meeting with the new top brass, Bob Wood, to plead for his venture. He didn't advocate alone. As our data showed, those like Telford who mobilized people performed better. The correlation between the mobilization aspect and performance was a high 0.66. Better workplaces, too. Ian Telford, Lorenza Pacetti, Jamie Oliver, Arunachalam Muruganatham, each channeled considerable energy and wisdom to gain other people's support. These individuals didn't wield formal authority over the people whom they sought to convince. Nor did they rely on personal charisma to dazzle their colleagues and others into submission. Rather, they mustered inspirational tactics and deployed smart grit to overcome opposition. Their tactics were behaviors, not personality traits. You, too, can learn to use these tactics effectively. The benefits are considerable. Forceful champions increase their performance, and they also build positive relationships with colleagues, customers, bosses, and others. Deploying forceful champion techniques allows us to amass this vital social capital, making it easier for us to galvanize support in the future. Forceful champion techniques also enable us to change the tenor of our workplaces. By inspiring others and deploying smart grit, we can render work more engaging and exciting for everyone. Adversaries become neutral or even friendly, and the workplace becomes a more enjoyable setting. That is not to say that the workplace becomes conflict-free or even that it should be. When your team faces a difficult problem and needs to make a decision, you want a certain amount of conflict between colleagues. As we'll see in the next chapter, conflict is part of performing in teams and a key part of becoming great at work. Key insights. Forceful champions. The work harder conventions. We often think that all we have to do is explain time and again the wonderful merits of our case, and bosses, peers, and employees will rise in support. We also believe that sheer grit, perseverance, and passion for long-term goals will allow us to overcome opposition to our work efforts. These conventions lead us to work harder, to communicate and then communicate some more, and to apply massive effort over time to overcome obstacles. The new work smarter perspective. The best performers don't just argue rationally for their ideas. They compel others to support them by deploying a two-punch maneuver. First, they inspire by evoking emotions in individuals whose support they need. Second, they apply smart grit, tailoring and adjusting their tactics in the face of opposition. Forceful champions, those who inspire others and apply smart grit, are more likely to persevere and achieve their goals at work. Key points. In our 5,000-person data set, forceful champions overall were likely to score a substantial 15 percentage points higher in their performance ranking than those who didn't inspire or use smart grit. Forceful champions use a variety of behaviors to arouse emotions and inspire coworkers to support their efforts. They make people angry about today and excited for tomorrow. They show and don't just tell, using striking photos and demos to evoke intense emotions. They make people feel purpose, connecting daily tedious work to a grander purpose. Forceful champions display smart grit to break down opposition and garner support for their projects. They consider the perspective of opponents, standing in their shoes, tailoring their tactics to address opponents' specific concerns and agendas. They confront opponents when needed. They make concessions they can live with to appease opponents. They co-opt opponents so that they too feel a sense of ownership. They exert pressure by mobilizing people to advocate on their behalf. Seven. Fight and unite. Diversity in council, unity in command. Cyrus the Great. Ulysses Carbo was going to make history. He and 1,400 other Cuban exiles were part of a planned invasion that would liberate Cuba in 1961 from Fidel Castro's communist regime. Air, naval, and ground forces had all been trained and mobilized. The strategy was to land on the beach, push aside the small defensive force, and inspire Cubans by the tens of thousands to rise up and march on Castro's army. Carbo was on board the freighter Houston. One of the four transport freighters, it left first with its cargo of men, fuel, and ammunition to rendezvous with the landing craft at the Bay of Pigs the night of April 16th. Battle plans started to go sideways when the promised landing craft failed to show on time. Outboard motorboats meant for shore patrol were pressed into service. The noise from the steam davits, crane-like devices used to lower the motorboats over the side of the ship, alerted the Cuban defensive forces to the invaders' approach. The delayed craft was supposed to have landed everybody in an hour and a half. Instead, By sunrise, only half of the troops were ashore. By dawn, the Houston and the other ships came under attack by T-33 fighters and aging Hawker Sea Fury fighters. At about 8 a.m., the Castro Army fired two rockets that ripped giant holes amidships. Captain Luis Morse, seeing that repair was hopeless, drove the Houston toward land to beach it. It sank, with only a few feet of superstructure above the water, half a mile from shore. The oil oozing from its wounds made evacuation difficult. Non-swimmers were packed into two 30-man lifeboats, while Carbo and the others struggled to swim ashore. Carbo managed to stay afloat by shedding his pants and boots. He ended up standing on the beach in his underwear. Carbo and his fellow invaders still succeeded in pressing past the meager defense forces on the beach, but over the next 3 days, Castro's 20,000 soldiers wrested control. The invaders were captured or killed. The uprising never materialized. Castro later traded the survivors to the United States for food and medicine. It was not the kind of history Carbo and his fellow men had hoped to make. So who planned and implemented this fiasco? It must have been the B team, right? Actually, it was the best and the brightest, a group of exceptionally qualified men in President John F. Kennedy's administration. Arthur Schlesinger, a Harvard historian who had been appointed special advisor to Kennedy, participated in the meetings where leaders discussed whether to launch the covert military force into an area known as the Bay of Pigs. As Schlesinger recounted, an intimidating group sat around the table, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Director of the Central Intelligence Agency, three Joint Chiefs resplendent in uniforms and decorations. Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, and Richard M. Bissell, deputy, were the masterminds behind the Bay of Pigs scheme, with Bissell showing maps and pitching to the group in the White House. According to Schlesinger, Bissell's mind was swift and penetrating, and he had an unsurpassed talent for lucid analysis and fluent exposition. Other talented participants included Robert McNamara, Secretary of Defense and former president of the Ford Motor Company, and McGeorge Bundy, national security advisor, who at age 34 became the youngest ever dean of the Faculty of Arts and Science at Harvard University. The problem with these group meetings wasn't a lack of intelligence in the room. It was a lack of critical thinking and thorough debate about the plan, its assumptions, and its weaknesses. You know those stilted meetings at work when everyone nods their heads and nobody has the courage to raise a dissenting view? That's what happened here. Before making the decision, President Kennedy asked for the opinion of his advisors, including the Undersecretary of State Thomas Mann, who earlier had opposed the plan privately with his boss. As everybody present expressed support, Mann said, I did the same. Recalled Secretary of Defense McNamara, I don't think Secretary of State Dean Rusk and I were enthusiastic, but we did not say, no, don't do it. McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, abdicated responsibility. It was not my job to be in visible disagreement with the President. Once he leaned in favor, I supported him. Schlesinger offered his doubts at the outset, sending several memos to President Kennedy outlining the hazards. But in the crucial days leading up to the decision, he too censored his objections, and he lived to regret it. I bitterly reproached myself for having kept so silent during those crucial discussions in the cabinet room. The Bay of Pigs disaster stands as a monument to a horrible team decision-making process. As the leader of the group, President Kennedy failed to foster a rigorous debate. The individual participants failed, too, in their responsibilities to voice dissent and articulate the downsides of the proposed plan. The best and the brightest failed. Meetings, meetings, and more meetings. As this fiasco demonstrates, how leaders and participants behave in teams can affect their individual performance a great deal. People achieve not just alone, but also by working in teams. In our 5,000-person study, a full 80% of people reported that leading teams well was really important in their jobs. Teamwork involves dividing up work among individuals, coordinating that work, debating in meetings, deciding, and implementing what's been decided.